How do you think the growth of the high-tech industry has affected the culture of the county, of Washington County?
Well, I think Tektronix can take a large piece of the credit for driving the growth of what they call Silicon Forest now. They were instrumental in getting academic institutions like OGI, installed, and they funded chairs in both the electrical engineering and physics department at OSU. I'm not sure what they did at Oregon, at U of O, but Tektronix has been quite active in supporting the academic community, and that the growth of the academic community has made this area very attractive to companies like Intel and other high-tech companies, where they want a base of both skilled operations people, technical people who are very hands-on, as well as engineers. Mm-hmm. So they have a good base. Mm-hmm. Here.
It would also attract families who want to put their kids in a system where the education is, public education is really good. I feel like, it can really affect all levels of society and all elements of society, really.
The Beaverton School District was one of the most highly regarded school districts in the Northwest when I moved into the area. It was something that people all around the Northwest knew about.
Yeah.
I think it still has a fairly good reputation.
Yeah.
Although Hillsborough's giving them a run for their money now.
Yeah. Okay.
But Intel has, the Intel moving into the area really helped consolidate this area as a high tech area.
Interesting. What do you mean? Or how did you do that?
I mean, Intel moving in prompted other companies like Sun Microsystems, Credence Semiconductor, other companies who might use their products to move into this area, because they're closer to the supply source.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Now there have been some rocky times. It seems like about every 7 to 9 years there's an economic hiccup that hits the people who are not too well prepared, and companies suffer. There were, I don't know whether if you came down the road from the north, you probably passed a couple of fledgling semiconductor companies that fell on hard times over the past few years. They basically had to close up their operations because they just because of the general global economy.
Yeah. What do you think the future is for TriQuint and for these high tech companies based here in this county?
Boy, I
any predictions?
Hate to speculate.
I know.
We are one of the largest manufacturers of components for cell phones, but there are several others that are very well known. There's a company called Anadigix in the Boston area, and Skyworks, and another company called RF micro devices or RFMD. So we have strong competition, but I think we have some process technologies that will allow us to thrive for in the cell phone market for several more years. And I hate to predict what the next widget is that's going to be the big thing. But I mean, nobody back in the 1980s envisioned the kind of explosive growth that the cell phone market has undergone. Worldwide, the market for, I think there's probably something like 10 to 15 million cell phones made a week in the world.
Wow.
Or maybe per day.
Wow.
And
wow.
You wonder how people must be eating them, you know,
or
losing them.
Exactly. Wait a minute. Yeah, where are these cell phones going?
But you can see it, you know, a company like Samsung or LG or Apple.
Yeah.
They're constantly coming out with new models.
True.
And they have new features. And, the market, people just flock to these new phones because they have to have the latest and greatest thing.
Right.
Even though what they're leaving behind is perfectly fine. I don't know whether that kind of scenario is self-sustaining or not. Would you think they're like in 1981, 82, the first IBM PC was delivered.
God, that's amazing.
And that exploded, and that became the thing everybody had to have for about 10 to 15 years. I mean, and now PCs are, they've come up with different flavors of them. They're not the big desktop thing anymore. You got laptops, notepads, mm-hmm. and now tablets. Don't know what's next there.
What kind of technology do you use?
I have at home. I have 7 desktops, mm-hmm. 3 laptops. None of the small notepads. No tablets, because I do too much programming, and they're not really useful for that. Mm-hmm. But I do have a Kindle.
You have a Kindle.
Yeah, because I read a lot, mm-hmm. and. That is, I was skeptical of that for a long while. I said, nobody will buy an electronic book reader. But I finally wound up buying one, and I'm hooked.
I know, they're great.
Yeah.
They really are, for people who like to read.
Yeah.
And if you do any traveling.
Yeah, it's so convenient.
So convenient. It really is. Although I study history, so I like to be in the basement of libraries looking at old dusty books.
Yeah. I
still like books. So.
But I don't know what the next, what the next new thing on the market is going to be. I thought GPS systems would take off to a much greater extent than they have. Although they are getting to be pretty pervasive, or global positioning mm-hmm. Chips in most cell phones these days.
Yeah.
But I thought people would have come up with a lot more consumer items there than they did. Now that's a technology that relies on satellite communications. Mm-hmm. Instead of cell phone style communications, but we build chips for that as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are also involved in. Didn't you do something with Mars?
Yeah. Well, we built some chips for several organizations that wound up in the Hubble microscope that was put in outer space, you know, and they're still running up there, and they've been up there for a number of years now.
Are there any specific projects or products or things that you've worked on over the years that are your favorite?
I mean, there's so many things. I think that, just going back, you know, I indicated that in the early days, the basic material technology was a fundamental issue that everybody was worried about. First, people were worried that they couldn't grow these wafers that we wanted, and then they said, if we do grow the wafers you want, we're going to run out of gallium. There's not going to be enough gallium in the world. So, hey, oh my God.
Crap. Not much.
But they solved that problem. They found large deposits of gallium in Australia. And then we wound up with a gallium glut. But I think the most enjoyable thing was, during those early years, our technology grew differently than the silicon technology did, because several companies had small gallium arsenide operations. It reflected this vertical integration. Like people like Watkins Johnson in the Bay Area, Hughes Research in Malibu Beach, McDonnell Douglas in Huntington Beach in California, Rockwell International in Newport, California. There were several companies on the East Coast. Everybody was kind of in the same boat. They had these real small fab operations. They were all fighting the same kind of problems, trying to build similar devices. And one of the most enjoyable things to me was that I knew many of the people in these different companies, and we did two things. We started an annual manufacturing technology symposium. And the first one was in, I think, 84 or 85. And also, we had several informal get-togethers. You know, several engineers would come from several companies, and we'd just sit down and tell everybody what kind of problems we were having, and share any solutions that people had. It was all domestic. You know, there were no international companies there, but because there were national security concerns with the technology at that time, so everything was held within the country. But we had. There were very good relationships amongst all of the competing people.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, and that, I think, was... there was only one company that refused to join with us, and that was because we had declined to hire their CEO as our CEO in the beginning. There were some political problems there.
Right, as to be expected, really.
Yeah.
How long did that happen, or is that still happening?
There is still some of that going on, to a much lesser extent, because things have stabilized quite a bit. We did go through a round of that kind of thing about 7 or 8 years ago that lasted for a few years, when we made a major technology shift in the late 90s through the early 2000s. As I indicated, we and everybody else had been building what they call MESFET devices as the fundamental building block of the circuits. Now, they work well in most applications, but they have some fundamental failings in others. And there was research going on in a new kind of crystal technology called heteroepitaxy, where you take a basic slice of gallium arsenide that's polished all nicely, and you grow layers, very thin layers of different materials on top of it with different electrical properties. Mm-hmm. And they used real exotic equipment to do that. And as you might expect, it's a technology that in its early days was like what we went through in our very earliest days, where you never knew from one minute to the next what was going to work. But we worked with several of the companies who were starting up and exploring this technology. And they were successful, and we in turn used these wafers with these specially grown layers to grow new classes of devices. There were two classes of devices that we started building. One is called a high electron mobility transistor, which is similar in concept to the MESFETs that we were building, mm-hmm. but didn't suffer from some of the same problems. And then there was another transistor called a heterojunction bipolar transistor, which was acknowledged to be the absolute fastest kind semiconductor device you could build. Of course, being the fastest meant it was also the most difficult. But in working with the vendors of the material, and then our fab people working on developing processes to build these devices, we were successful in transitioning away largely from the MESFET methodology that we'd used into these new technologies. Mm. Most of what we build today is based on these new technologies.
Okay.
Now, we had to work very, very closely with our vendors.
Okay.
We had to share some of our proprietary information with them, and they had to share some of their proprietary information with us.
Wow.
And there was no restrictions placed on either company as to what they could do internally with that information. They just couldn't share it with anybody else.
But I
think that kind of thing will occur sporadically, mm-hmm. from time to time. And I know that the silicon industry has done similar things on occasion. In particular, Intel, they use a very specialized kind of silicon wafer and they've worked closely with their suppliers to get exactly what they need.
What they need.
Yeah.
What do engineers do when they're not working?
Oh, it's quite varied. Many of the engineers are avid outdoorsmen, hikers, skiers. I was an inveterate skier until kids came along. That seems to put a stop to that kind of thing for a while.
Yeah.
But they have all the normal run-of-the-mill hobbies. We have a quite a mix of men and women in the various engineering roles. design engineers, process engineers, product engineers who manage the products once they've seen the light of day. People doing failure analysis and reliability. And there's a fairly strong mix of men and women in both areas. And it's like you would find in any, heterogeneous company. There's some people are coin collectors, other people are mountaineers. Quite a number of people do the hood to coast run here, both men and women from the company. They have myself. I'm a going back to my days of wanting to be a mechanic, an automobile mechanic. I have a couple of old junkers in my garage that I keep threatening to work on. It's quite varied. Then people are generally very accustomed to working long hours on occasion. Because generally when an unexpected problem occurs or unanticipated demand for something occurs, people have to respond quickly, and that seems to be part of the culture here. That an 8 to 10 hour, a 10 to 12 hour day is not uncommon.
Yeah.
Sometimes longer.
But. Yeah. I know. I'm thinking about this group of people who you guys were starting TriQuint, and all the different roles that you were playing in that company and developing that company and figuring out not just the product itself but the company itself. And I'm thinking about people at home, if you have a wife at home, or if you must have had
they have to be very support. Very understanding.
Some really strong support in that.
Yeah,
I can imagine. And thinking about flying to and from various regions, maybe up along the West Coast, talking with
when we were my first year with the group was a lot of it was focused on designing the fab operation that was sited inside Tektronix property, so that was an advantage for us. But I had to spend a lot of time working with architects and other facilities people to design the fab, and then we had to decide what equipment we were going to buy. So myself and several of these key engineers that I hired spent a lot of time traveling. I'd spend about 2.5 weeks out of every month away from home, traveling to all across the country, working with equipment vendors. And at that time, the equipment vendors, they didn't even know what gallium arsenide was. It was something strange. Now, we had to educate them on that.
Yeah.
The material, they were very familiar with silicon, and they had techniques, they had equipment that would handle silicon wafers quite well, but they failed miserably in handling gallium arsenide because of its properties. Just to give you an idea, gallium arsenide is four times the same size. Gallium arsenide is four times heavier than silicon. So, transport systems that would move wafers around, the motors and the equipment would burn out because the wafers were so heavy. Also, gallium arsenide is transparent to infrared light. It's also highly insulating. So the detectors that the vendors used to sense where a wafer was automatically on the equipment would fail. And of course the wafer would break.
Oh, yeah.
So we had to work through all of those kind of issues with every vendor we dealt with. And
that's an enormous undertaking. You're having somebody completely reassess how they're going about creating this product.
Yeah. But again, we were lucky, very, very lucky, in that we were starting out when the general high-tech industry was falling flat on its face. And the equipment vendors, they would do anything to get a sale.
Mm.
They would bend over backwards, to invest engineering time, change the design of the equipment to meet the special needs of this exotic new material.
Right.
And so again, the timing was perfect. We got a core group of top-notch people from, like I say, all the way from the technical operations staff up to the engineering staff. Got real good people there. We got real good support from our equipment vendors. The material suppliers were hungry too.
They were ready for some business too.
Yeah.
Really interesting. Really interesting.
It grew up in a different way than most startup companies grow up. Most startup companies are formed by a small group of people with a good idea, and they go out and they get venture capital to fund them. And they have to produce right now.
Yeah.
I mean, they have to be successful right out of the box.
Yeah.
TriQuint was sheltered quite well by Tektronix during that first period of its life, because there were some senior people at Tektronix who had a lot of foresight. There was a vice president by the name of Wim Velsink. At the time, he was the vice president of engineering. Another senior manager, Tom Long, and another one, Larry Bowman. They were very strong internal advocates in Tektronix for us. We also had some advocates in the various business units of Tektronix as well that wanted to use our equipment or our material. But those three people basically ran interference for us with the rest of the Tektronix management and ensured that we had the funding, and they gave us the time to solve some of these basic issues that we had to deal with.
Yeah, it's like sort of a mutually beneficial relationship. As one person's growing and another company's reorganizing. I feel like timing is really, I hadn't thought about that before this interview, just the timing in which these companies emerged. It's really important.
Yeah, if we had done this 5 years later, it may or may not have been a success.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
But
do you have children in the high-tech industry?
I have one son working for Intel and one son working for TriQuint.
Really?
Yeah.
Here you go.
Yeah.
So there is a legacy that's being handed to your own generation.
My older boy is working for Intel in Folsom. He's a computer type. He's doing a lot of basic low-level programming for embedded systems. So he got my programming interest. Mm-hmm. And the other one got my materials interest.
Cool. That has to be kind of fun.
Yeah.
That has to be good.
Yeah. Let's see where we are.
I know, I was going to say, you're an incredible speaker. I feel like we've covered actually everything on my list.
I was just trying to think. Tektronix did spawn a large number of companies, or supported a large number of companies, several of which are still highly successful in this area. One that comes to mind right away is Cascade Microtech. I don't know whether you've heard of that company or not. They have a big facility on Cornell Road, just a few miles from here, and they have another one in Beaverton. They fabricate fixtures that are used for testing some of these fixtures and equipment for testing some of these very high speed devices. So it's a real exotic technology discipline. Those two people were the two co-founders of that company, actually were part of the original R&D group that I joined. Mm-hmm. And about a year later, they decided that they wanted to make this a business. So we at Triquint, together with Tektronix, gave them seed funding and a lot of the patents that went along with their work, and they've made it a very successful company. One other company that you may or may not have heard of is Planar Systems.
I have heard of that one.
Now, the fellow who coerced me to come back to the R&D group was an individual by the name of Jim Hurd. He and I had worked together in the old R&D group on some of the stuff back in the early 70s. Well, he decided that he wanted to take this electroluminescent display technology off and make a separate company out of that.
Okay.
And he did that, and they were quite successful.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they, like all companies, have had their ups and downs, but they're still out there alive and kicking.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of those relationships that you fostered or that were fostered by working with people in Tektronix, this probably still exists a little bit. I'm sure a lot of these people are still around this area, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely.
Very cool. Yeah. And you can sort of just look at each other's careers sort of blossom out of Tektronix and these various spin-offs that are popping up all over.
Yeah.
And then, of course, understanding the impact that economics probably has on business.
Right. I keep thinking of other ones. Maxim bought the Tektronix integrated circuit operation. They actually bought the whole building from Tektronix. So they're located on the corner of the Tektronix campus, and they build the same kind of devices that we were building when I was part of that organization. And several of the original Tektronix people are still there working in that operation.
Wow.
And there was one other that I thought of. There was like you said, Tektronix did so many different things. You shake your head wondering how they could ever have done so many different things all at once and kept their sanity. There's a circuit board company in Forest Grove, and the name escapes me right now, but it was originally a Tektronix captive circuit board company. And Tech basically underwrote them and allowed them to go off on their own.
Mm-hmm.
There's another company called Max Tech that builds accessories for test systems that was spun off out of Tektronix.
Okay. Tektronix, reading about Tektronix, there's a lot of really unique terminology. Like, we've, as a class, we've done a little bit of research. We've come across terms like the Camelot of technology, or the mother of technology, you know.
Yeah.
And
well, it really, if you ever get a chance, you should try and, at one of the libraries, try and check out that video that OPB did. It's about a 45-minute discussion of how Tektronix was formed.
Right, and I actually did watch that.
Oh, you did?
My boyfriend and I watched it.
I mean, they started out in a little shop over on Hawthorne Street, repairing TV, repairing radios, basically.
Yeah.
And he, Howard Vollum had been an electronics tech in the Navy, and he had this idea for test equipment that would allow you to see the signals for the first time. And at the same time, Hewlett and Packard were doing the same thing in the Bay Area.
That's right.
No, it's interesting, Hewlett-Packard followed the same kind of pattern that Tektronix did.
Mm-hmm.
Only they were a little bit behind Tektronix. Hewlett-Packard split into two separate companies. Hmm. One retained the Hewlett-Packard name, and another one was called Agilent.
Okay.
And the Hewlett-Packard side kept their PC business, their computer business and workstation business and software. And Agilent took all of the test equipment. As it turns out, Agilent's been far, far more successful than Hewlett-Packard. But in that time frame when we were formed, the premier gallium arsenide company, one that was was a world recognized leader in the technology, was Hewlett-Packard. And they had a head start on us. They had some absolutely brilliant people working down there.
Mm-hmm.
But they made some mistakes in funding the company.
Mm-hmm.
They decided that they were going to keep that operation, what they call, totally captive. They weren't going to sell to the outside world. They were going to use the devices the group made to leverage on their equipment to give them an advantage over all of the other vendors in the test equipment market. And that group basically vanished over a period of time.
Why, I wonder?
They were underfunded. Because they were a totally captive company. They couldn't get the kind of funding they needed to grow.
Yeah. It sounds like a good idea, right? To like rev up this sort of engine, right? And like put all of your money keep your money internal and like build it up. But you have to have, in reality, you have to have something coming and going.
There's a balance that companies have to draw in that respect. I mean, there's an old saying, if you want it done right, do it yourself. Well, that's the way Tektronix and Hewlett-Packard operated for the first 20 years of their life, and it was very successful, but then doing it yourself got to be so expensive and so diluting. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're spending your time figuring out why you can't build a piece of wire instead of why you can't build a test, you know, a piece of test equipment.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the movement was right. It was. I won't say it wasn't heart-wrenching for some of the people who were involved in the transitions. You know, when companies get, you know, partitioned off, it's quite an emotional change for a lot of people. And some people they thrived on it, others didn't. We were lucky. We were one of the small group that thrived. Of course, I've been told many times that all the people I hired were the troublemakers in the company. All the people always complained about the way things were being done.
Really?
So I wound up with a group of troublemakers. But they proved to be what it took to be successful.
They paid off in the long run.
Yep. Yeah. It was a lot of fun, but there was a lot of, a lot of times when you wondered if you were ever going to get it right.
Mm.
Yeah. One of the people I worked with for several years decided he was going to get out of the high-tech industry and go and grow mushrooms. And he did. He grew mushrooms commercially for 10 years here in the Beaverton area until he finally decided to retire. He was growing the chanterelles and several of the other exotic mushrooms. I talked to him once not long ago, and he said, growing mushrooms is just like being an engineer in the fab. You try an experiment and it fails. You try another experiment and it fails. Finally, you give up your hands and walk away and it works. And you have no idea why.
Wow.
So it was just like what we did when we were developing the processes for the devices we were building.
That's interesting. Do you think you can say the same thing today? It's still the same way.
Oh no!
It's
much better today. We were starting from a knowledge base of near zero. Nobody knew very much about this new material, what its behavior would be like, we didn't even have a good handle on how to get the starting material clean before we ever started to use it. Everything was a first-time experience for us. Whereas at that time in the silicon industry, they probably had several million man-hours around the world of experience that had been shared by people moving from company to company and through conferences and whatever. Everything we did was almost like a first-time experience. And that's why it was so incredibly useful for us to various people in different competing companies to get together and just say, this is what we're doing, and it isn't working.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
And
sharing what today would be considered, major corporate secrets. But the whole community was so interested in just making the technology survive that they were willing to share some of the aches and pains that that they were experiencing with us, and we did the same.
Mm-hmm. And it also sounds like you said some of the secrets that you probably wouldn't. Do people still share that information?
There is, I think, a lot more openness in the gallium arsenide fabrication process community than there is in the silicon to even today. Mm. I mean, that manufacturing technology conference is still going on. It's now an international conference, but people do, you know, they get up and they bare their soul about some of the problems they're fighting, and mm-hmm. things they may not share is how much material is being processed or how many devices they're selling.
Yeah.
Or details of who their customers are. That's definitely off limits. In terms of the working with the basic material, yeah. that is still, I think, a very there's still a lot of synergy between the companies.
Good.
Yeah.
It's like the core of scientific experiments and things too, yeah. I think, right? It's like going through a process, hoping it succeeds, doesn't succeed, and having to express that with somebody and share information and try and get to the bottom of it. That's my perspective, my personal perspective, is that you're sort of a detective and you're sort of trying to put pieces together and solve a problem that you don't even know exists yet.
Yeah.
It sounds like a very exciting career and a really thrilling, pretty thrilling life.
Yeah.
And driving out here and looking at these incredible buildings and restaurants and an entire community that's been developed around this type of technology. It's really powerful. And everybody I know has a cell phone. Almost everybody, you know? I mean, even my grandmother, who, you know, is long lost when it comes to technology. I just think that it's so great to be a part of this process and hopefully enlighten people to what's going on out here and how it's changed over time.
Yeah. What do you think will happen with these, I don't want to call them reports, it'd be more like papers or discussions. How will they...
So that
will they be made public? Or?
Yeah. So the Washington County, the History Museum is actually going to curate a show. I think that's coming next year. They're going to use the information from these interviews that we are doing, the information that we're gathering, doing research. They're doing their own research. So there will actually be an exhibit on the Silicon Valley or. Silicon Forest, yeah, not the valley. That will be, you'll definitely get an invitation to. And then the next step for me will be to go through and transcribe our interview, send it off to you, and give you a chance to look over it. And then it actually goes into a public archive, and it's available to other historians who are going to want to research this area and say, well, you know, what can I pull from this, and what's available to me?
Yeah, I really wanted to put together a history of this company, but I spent about a year and a half working with yet another startup in this area, and when I went over there. I had pictures of some of the very early days,
You know,
the people, the equipment, the different, you know, labs, mm-hmm. Some of the things we built. But it vanished when I went to on that assignment.
Yeah, yeah. Priorities, things come up.
I would have loved to have found that so we could put together an archive just for our own.
You should, yeah. It's a valuable, it's an important, valuable part of every company and of every person.
Yeah.
It's having the history available, you know, to people.
Fortunately, we still have a lot of people around the company here who date back to the early days.
Cool.
Most of which I hired, but there's one. I think I mentioned it in the early discussion. There was the first time I walked into the lab and saw the lady cleaning a wafer. She is still here. She's one of in a senior product management role now.
Cool. Were there many women at the beginning?
Yes. Probably. Certainly not a 50-50 mix. At that point in time, in the late 70s and early 80s, it was hard to find women who went through the sciences or any of the pure sciences or engineering. There were people coming, and we hired several of them. One of our senior reliability engineers was a lady. Our human resources director was one of the best HR people I've ever encountered in my life. She was with us for several years. Several people in the non-technical roles. Mm-hmm. We had a VP of, or a CFO, who was a lady for several years, did a fantastic job for us. But over the last, I'd say the last 10 years, 15 years at most, seen a lot greater influx of women coming out of college with either bachelor's degrees or advanced degrees in chemistry, math, mm-hmm. less so in physics, several in engineering. And we have a large number of professional engineers, women professional engineers in the company right now. I'm not sure there's any, don't know whether we have any women on staff right now. Anybody in the executive staff who are women. There may be. I've kind of lost interest.
You're
in that part
retired.
Of the
business. Yeah, exactly.
But
great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope you can make sense out of it.
Definitely. Oh, yes. I'm excited to kind of go back and research.